I want to talk about this. We're going to be speaking shortly with Michael Link, I believe, and I want to say that today's headline is this is the Globe and Mail, Israeli strikes kill dozens, including six children at water collection point. There was a time they didn't mention who was dropping the bombs, but or firing the missiles, but now we have it. We have also Michael Link, I believe. Are you there, sir?
How are you today?
Well, very good. Well, good and sad. I was just reading the headline from today about the situation in Gaza. Of course, you were UN rapporteur on the issue of Palestinians and their conditions and their rights, and our professor at the University of Western Ontario, and many times I know you have visited and you've been over this ground, but let's talk about this headline. Israeli strikes killed dozens, including six children at water collection point. We keep having this phenomena. Actually, this is, I would say, for the past 2 weeks, this is all I've read, is it they say they have a place where people can go to collect food and or water, and they somehow or another, they end up being attacked. Are you following this, and can you explain how this could be happening?
Well, I'm following this as closely as anybody concerned about the Middle East is. I am obviously deeply shocked with every morning that I wake up to see these kinds of headlines. As UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said, you know, Gaza has become a graveyard for children, but it's become a graveyard for all Palestinians. At least 57,000 Palestinians, by conservative official records, have been killed over the last 21 months. Estimates by medical geographers and epidemiologists suggest that it's, in fact, much higher. Perhaps as high as 80,000 Palestinians have died, perhaps somewhere in the range of 170,000 to 180,000 Palestinians have died during the course of this 21-month-old genocide. And truly, there's no other word to be able to describe what's going on but a genocide. Many genocide scholars have said that the actions of Israel in Gaza meet the legal and historical definition of a genocide. That is repeated by a number of very respected international organizations, such as Amnesty International and Doctors Without Borders. Mm-hmm. Recently, both the former foreign affairs chief of the European Union, Josep Borrell, said this was a genocide, as did Martin Griffiths, who was until 2024 the head of humanitarian affairs for the United Nations. It's important to be able to name things as they are. The French writer Albert Camus once said that calling things by their wrong name only adds to the afflictions of the world. And I think we have to be forthright in saying what this is, because it then compels all of the signatories to the 1948 Genocide Convention, which is virtually every country in the world, to actually do something with respect to stopping this genocide. The whole point of having a genocide convention is not to get historians 20 or 30 years from now comfort in naming what's been going on in 2025. It's to compel the political leaders to bring a genocide or a genocide in the making to an absolute end, and to seek accountability for those who have been perpetuating such a crime.
Mm-hmm. In today's Globe story, they quote the energy minister, Mr. Cohen, Eli Cohen, and he was on Israeli television talking about this matter, and he said his ministry will not help rebuild infrastructure in Gaza, quotes, Gaza should remain an island of ruins into the next decade. I mean, language like that doesn't leave any space for debating what this is. This is a minister of the government saying what the policy is, or should be.
Yes. You know, if I can be lawyerly for a minute, in order to establish that actions of a government in the conduct of a war conflict amount to genocide, you have to prove two things. You have to prove that the acts of the government are leading towards the destruction of a people in whole or in part. And then you also have to prove intent. And there have been genocide scholars, indeed scholars inside of Israel, who have now compiled databases of hundreds of statements made by Israeli political leaders, Israeli military leaders, journalists, and public influencers, who have said statements that amount to incitement to genocide. The Minister Cohen's statement is just the latest that I've seen, where either we're saying that no food, fuel, or medical supplies or water are going to enter Gaza. You know, there's no such thing as an innocent person in Gaza. And to this, Gaza will remain in ruins, presumably forever, with respect to this. This is all aimed both to demonstrate intent, but also matches with the actions of Israel that can only lead us to a conclusion that this is a genocide. Mm-hmm. So I'm as disturbed as you or any right-thinking person when I see statements made like this, knowing that they match the kind of asymmetrical total warfare that we've seen over the past 21 months.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about the involvement, for example, of the President of the United States. Not the first U.S. president, by the way, to go kind of over the line, and when he talks about how to resolve things, but he speaks openly about population transfer, removing the people of Gaza, putting them, say, in Jordan or maybe somewhere in Africa, while they set up a casino colony on the Gaza Strip. I mean, that is criminal itself, isn't it? He's the president of the United States. He's got no if that's a goal. That's a criminal project.
Yes. The 1948 Genocide Convention prohibits genocide. It refers to it as, we refer to it now as the crime of crimes. But it's a crime not only to commit genocide, it's also a crime to be complicit in genocide, which the United States has been both under the prior presidential administration and the current one through its supply of weapons to Israel to be able to conduct its total war on Gaza, its diplomatic shielding that it gives Israel at the Security Council and in other international forums. And go to your specific point with respect to mass displacement. I mean, the term ethnic cleansing arose in the 1990s when we saw the wars in the Balkans, and that's an accurate popular description of cleansing removing a population from its homeland. Mm-hmm. We call that forced displacement in law. Forced displacement is both a war crime and a crime against humanity, and it could be part of a larger charge with respect to the genocide. What Israel is planning to do now is to concentrate the vast majority of the Palestinian population in Gaza, which would be over 2 million people, into a barbed wire camp. They call it a humanitarian city, but I think we can all see through that euphemism. It would be a form of a concentration camp of which they enter, they cannot leave, and the only way they can leave is through agreeing to leave Gaza and to leave Palestine. That amounts to forced displacement. It has been mentioned as such by all of the major international human rights organizations over the past several weeks, including Amnesty International, including Human Rights Watch. And we now see statements made in the Israeli press. I'm looking at the English edition of Haaretz, the Israeli Daily, where they're quoting former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert as saying this would amount to a concentration camp and it would be a war crime. Mm-hmm. It astonishes me how passive the leadership in most of the global north is towards this. Luckily, we do have the Prime Minister of Spain using the word genocide to describe what's going on. He's pushing for stronger action by the European Union, which is heavily divided within itself in its divided house. But I've heard virtually nothing from the leader of our country, Canada, that would match the scale of the violations of international law that are now occurring.
Mm-hmm. By the way, if you were the one bringing the charges, one of the things you would bring would be that most armies, and I assume that in the language of the Israeli army, a prisoner is a responsibility of the army. They're responsible to maintain his life, to see that they have nutrition, see that they have medicine, see that they're not harmed. But this seems to be an army, and U.S. Army is starting to sound the same, where they don't go by this doctrine at all.
We have reports coming from both, responsible journalists within Israel, many of them who work for and write for Haaretz, but also valiant human rights organizations within Israel, such as Israeli Committee Against Torture, which have reported what has been going on with respect to Palestinians captured and imprisoned by Israel during the course of this conflict, both in Gaza, but also in the West Bank as well. There are a number of medical staff from Gaza who've been imprisoned for months and months now by Israel. One leading doctor, his family is the lawyer for that doctor is reporting that he's lost 30% of his body weight in prison, that he's undergoing forms of torture, all with respect to allegations that he worked for Hamas. His family denies that.
Oh, by the way, could I?
Hamas or not, once you're a prisoner,
go ahead.
You are entitled to respectful, responsible treatment, which would mm-hmm. exclude any kind of physical harm or any kind of physical or psychological torture while you're being in prison. And you must be released within a certain period of time if you're, if the allegations made against you cannot be established under a fair procedure.
Yeah. Since you raised that name, Hamas, I just thought it would be important to make this note that to ask you this, and we're speaking to Michael Link, who was a UN rapporteur for Palestine, Gaza. I wanted to lost my point. Hamas. They use the word, but there's a fighting group, an armed group. But Hamas remains a political organization. Hamas was in a political contest, in my memory, with the Palestinian Authority. There was an election which Hamas won. Now, I know that was a long time ago, but that was a political contest, and have constituted political leadership. So work, schools, medicine, whatnot, that was under their jurisdiction. It's now being treated as though there's just this one lump term and that everybody is allegedly a terrorist if they belong to this group. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Let me say several things. One is, the actions of Hamas on October 7th and other Palestinian armed groups from Gaza in killing Israeli civilians and capturing Israeli civilians to be brought back into Gaza would be war crimes. And the International Criminal Court has considered issuing arrest warrants under the Rome Statute of 1998 with respect to three Hamas leaders, all of whom I think have since been confirmed to have been killed. Second, you're right. Hamas is a multifaceted organization. It has a military wing. It has, if you like, a government and public service wing as well. The public service wing, which would include police officers, which would include administrators of various departments, say going to health or social welfare, would be considered to be civilians, and they're not entitled to be targeted during the course of a conflict.
Well, they should be properly labeled, right? Understood who they are.
Yes. You know, Israel has a very broad and promiscuous definition of who is a terrorist and therefore can be targeted within its laws. International humanitarian law does not allow that. International humanitarian law and the way in which Israel interprets IHL, there's a vast gulf between these two. So the ability to sort of capture doctors who may be working in a hospital that may be treating wounded Hamas militants or soldiers brought there is not, he or she would not be guilty of any crime by doing that. They're following the precepts of international humanitarian law. The fact that you may work for the health ministry in running the 35 or 36 hospitals in Gaza does not thereby make you a just target for military assault or for missiles with mm-hmm. respect to that. The army or the organization that Israel would have to be able to target legitimately would be Hamas militants and fighters. And the way in which this war has been conducted, it seems that it's far from only wanting to destroy or decapitate Hamas. It's to make Gaza entirely unlivable, such as to rid Gaza of most, if not all, of its Palestinian population. That is a war aim seems to be becoming clearer and clearer, even in the Israeli press.
The big question has been looming up in my mind, and we've spoken to you about this in the past, and actually the last time we did speak to you was a question of providing aid, and then I think the acronym is UNOR, or what do you call it?
UNRWA?
UNRWA. Yes, pardon me, UNRWA. Now, I don't see them at all anymore. All I see are people called a private organization financed by the U.S., I gather, and suddenly they call themselves the humanitarians. What happened to UNRWA?
Sure. Prior to the end or the very beginning of March 2025, there had been a ceasefire since about the 19th of January. UNRWA, along with other UN agencies such as the World Food Program and UNICEF and WHO, and along with a number of private international humanitarian organizations, were supplying humanitarian aid into Gaza, roughly at scale to what was needed, somewhere between 600 to 700 trucks a day between the end of January and the very beginning of March were entering into Gaza. And they were distributing food, water, fuel, and other humanitarian needs at a roughly 400 depots around Gaza. Israel has for a long time had UNRWA as a target, a political target, because it winds up representing the aspirations of Palestinian refugees who were expelled from their indigenous homeland in 1948 and again in 1967. UNRWA directly maintains the political issue of the Palestinian refugees on the international agenda. That is an anathema to the Israeli leadership. So it was trying to end UNRWA's operations both in Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank. And to date, it's largely succeeded. Only UNRWA, with its 13,000 employees within Gaza, was able to have the operational experience and the operational capacity to be able to distribute humanitarian aid at scale to the 2+ million Palestinians who are there. UNRWA is now banned from Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza, and in its place is this so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, a euphemism if there ever was one, which is funded by the United States, $30 million, and which employs both ex-U.S. military contractors along with the IDF. And they've reduced the 400 food and aid depots to four, three in the south of Gaza, one in the middle of Gaza, none in the north of Gaza. And they intend this, as in the words of the United Nations officials themselves, this is weaponized starvation. This is subverting all of the principal purposes of humanitarian aid in order to gather the Palestinians into one area as a prelude, it would appear, to wanting to expel them. Yeah. And there's no other purpose with respect to this. And we know from reporting over the last 5.5 weeks since the food started to enter into Gaza again after a 10-week total ban, that there have been over 800 Palestinians have been killed at these four depots or trying to walk towards these depots to get humanitarian aid for their families.
Amazing. It sounds like organized destruction. Again, Michael Link, and I need to, in the two minutes remaining, I want to ask you, I noticed that the American response, and maybe some even the Europeans, I can't tell, they've decided to shoot the messenger, right? They're now beginning to attack the office you once had, which is UN rapporteur. It looks like an organized campaign to actually basically undermine and perhaps destabilize the United Nations by removing this office itself.
Yes. Let me answer this quickly because I know time is running short. My successor, Francesca Albanese, a renowned Italian human rights lawyer, has been in the position for 3 years. She, like me, was not permitted to go into Israel. But the United States last week issued a ban for her entering into the United States to be able to present her reports to the United Nations General Assembly. This is unheard of. I'm not aware of any other time that the United States, as a host country to the United Nations, has banned a UN official from entering into its country in order to be able to carry out the mandate given to that particular individual. Keep in mind that the United States allows representatives from North Korea. It allows representatives from Iran. Neither country, which has had diplomatic relationships with yes. the United States for decades, if ever, to attend and operate at the UN headquarters in New York. And I'm hoping that the United Nations leadership will take a firm stand against the United States in what it's done. Otherwise, it's undermined the very legitimacy and operations of the United Nations and will allow the United States to further abuse its position as a host country and abuse its agreement with the United Nations to take actions against any criticism that it doesn't like.
Yeah. I hate to say it, it was kind of an echo of the past. That there was subjects like this that brought about the end of the League of Nations. Yeah, so I hope Canadians will wake up to this, and I guess you would agree with me. As far as I know, the Canadian government has said nothing about this phenomenon.
I'm not aware of anything the government has said or done with respect to this.
Michael Link, professor, Western University, and former rapporteur for the United Nations, thank you very much. It's been very informative. And if you will, we'd like to have you back because particularly that office that you once served, we want to know that that's still there. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much for having me, Phil.
Okay. Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Steve Fruitman is in the house, and the show will be coming up rather shortly. And yes, it was Lee Morgan and not Joe Morgan. Sidewinder earlier. And Pedro, thanks very much. We'll see you all next week.